Blog Talk Radio.
You're listening to Aramar Tefio on blogtalkradio.com. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of all hosts, guests, or producers, and the show is for a mature audience. Hello, good evening. Welcome to Feed Your Head. I'm Ruth Anna Marte-Fio, and in our first hour, we have Alan Mackey from Minnesota. We're going to be talking about, among other things, the unionization or the attempt to unionize the casino workers. And then our second hour, we have Ole Damagord, who is in Spain, and he's talking about different people who have been responsible for assassinations of political leaders and people in business throughout the years. And he does talk about Operation 40 in this. So let's just go right on. Alan, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I am great. You are, you know, we're passing you around, evidently, on this station.
I appreciate the opportunity to talk about these issues.
Well, yeah, you're on with Stuart on Social Insight every other week. And so it's like, okay, yeah, it's good to have you on because we're talking about some things that you don't talk about there. I have, people would say soft spots in my head, but there's so many issues in the world and so many people who are downtrodden. And, you know, our heart goes out to everybody who is suffering through this. But I know for me that there's a few things that get me going more than others. Palestine is one, Kashmir is one, and Native Americans. And I do have some Native blood in me, which I didn't know growing up. It's so funny, though. I always like to dress up, quote unquote, like an Indian. And, you know, all this stuff, I had these things going on with me. My dolls, I had lots of little Indian dolls and things, but I didn't know until I was grown and found out that I had Cherokee blood. So, but it's always been something, because it seems so horrid. I guess I relate more to it because it's on the continent, in the country that I live in, and I didn't know about a lot of this treatment as I was growing up. And, you know, I mean, I keep finding out that so much of it hasn't changed. And I'm sure that you're aware of that. You work very closely with Native people in Minnesota, and you're involved in the casino business, not the business end of it, but the people end of it. Do you want to talk a little bit about that? I do want to mention that we did, although I did, and it was probably too late, I sent an email to the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association to try to have someone come on and maybe, you know, give a different side, like their view, because I don't think their view is going to do much for us. But I haven't heard back. So,
okay.
It seems, you know, the natives have so many things that they're dealing with. And I have run into Shoshone Bannock. I lived in Pocatello, Idaho, and right outside is the reservation. And I've been out there, and then, you know, I've seen the natives in town, and alcohol seems to be a major problem. Actually, on the site, the MN Indian Gaming Association.com, they have a list of some things, and they're talking about Native Americans are 6 times more likely to die of alcohol-related causes. And I know that fetal alcohol syndrome is a big thing. There's suicides are much more apt to happen on the reservations or with the Natives. There's so many just health problems and mental problems because of the way they treated still. And I don't know how you feel about the whole gambling thing, but I mean, whatever, it is here and it's probably here to stay. So it does bring in a lot of revenue. And in Minnesota, it brings in millions and millions a year.
Billions, actually.
Yeah, okay. And it seems that there is no trickle-down, though, Alan. I mean,
no, none at all. The problem is with Indian gaming is it's Indian gaming in name only. Let me give you an example. Here in Minnesota, there are casinos are spread all over the state. I work with casino workers in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. All three of these states have large numbers of casinos. One of the major problems is that not one single Native American or Native American tribe owns a single slot machine. Not any place in the United States. There's 350 of these Indian casinos spread out across the United States, and not one slot machine, not one table game is owned by Native Americans. These the slot machines, anybody can go down to the Commissioner of Public Safety here in Minnesota, and it's the Commissioner of Public Safety who is required to keep track of these slot machines. In other words, every single slot machine is registered just like an automobile. It has a serial and model number, and it also tells where it's located on the floor of these casinos at any given time.
Okay.
And none of the owners of these slot machines are Native Americans or Native American tribes. They're all owned by very wealthy, racist white mobsters. And like I say, anybody can go down and find out who owns these slot machines. It's no big secret, but they try to conceal it and make it a secret. The same thing in all the other 350 or so casinos, Indian gaming casinos across this country. Even the you know, the largest casinos, you can talk about Foxwoods Casinos out east, or you can talk about the Hard Rock Casinos owned by the Seminoles in Florida, which is a huge gambling empire. They don't own any of their slot machines. So all the wealth, all the profits are being skimmed right off the top by these mobsters. And if you look at the Gun Lake Casino, where we're fighting with management in Michigan right now, just south of Grand Rapids, Michigan, the management company that's been called in to manage this casino by the Gun Lake tribe down there is the Fertitta family. The Fertittas are a well-known mobster family in this country. In fact, Gary Hart was the lead prosecutor against Frank Fertitta and these Kansas City mobsters who were skimming the casino.
Uh-oh.
And as a result of the Fertitta family managing this casino in Gun Lake, they get 85% of the profits. 85% of the profits they go directly into their pockets for managing this casino. And
right,
it's a big casino down
right
there.
Why did the tribe hire them? I mean, there was no other. Why did they choose them?
All the tribes essentially do the same thing. The reason is because the mobsters have to look out for their own profits up from these slot machines. They don't trust anybody else to do it. So, you know, it's these so-called management companies that come in to manage these casinos. And in some cases, the tribes are allowed to manage the casinos if the mobsters trust them to do it. But the mobsters have to trust them to do it. Here where I live, the Red Lake Gaming Enterprises, which is supposedly owned by the Red Lake Nation, they have a guy that comes out of Price Waterhouse who was involved in taking over trucking companies. His job was to take over trucking companies. He made them look bad on paper so that mobsters could come in and buy up these trucking companies real cheap. And some of the same things were seen happening in the casino industry. So, you know, What looks good on paper is not good for the people. In fact, the only thing the people get out of these casinos, the only thing Native Americans get out of these casinos, is constant and perpetual debt. Anybody can see there's constant additions being made on these casinos. The cost of these casinos, Red Lake Gaming Enterprises built a little casino down in Red Lake. The cost was over $25 million. Anybody can look at a public school and compare a public school building to this casino and understand that there's no way it costs anywhere near $20 million. So the people are being ripped off left and right in every conceivable way when it comes to this casino industry, and that's why we have so much poverty on all these Indian reservations across the country. You walk into any of these casinos and see the money being taken in, and any reasonably intelligent person has to wonder, why is one single Native American family living in poverty in this country if this is really truly an Indian gaming industry?
Yeah.
And let me explain this before we go on. It was Meyer Lansky, when he got kicked out of Cuba, that came up with this great big idea. He wondered, where can we go where the feds can't touch us?
Yes.
And he came up with the idea that we'll use the Indian nations to establish the casino industry that we lost in Cuba. And it's become a huge empire as a result of what Meyer Lansky first imagined. So, you know, this is the kind of scheme that's going on, ripping off the people left and right. Here in Minnesota, 44,000 casino workers. This includes the people working the casinos, the people working the hotels and motels, the restaurants, the bars, the gift shops, the gas stations, the convenience stores, barber shops and beauty shops, all these businesses associated with the casino business. Well, these 44,000 people are all forced to work in these loud, noisy, smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages and without any rights at all, not under federal or state labor laws or tribal laws.
Right.
So, you know, this is the situation these workers have been forced into, and the compacts were created by the Democrats. These compacts were agreements between the tribal nations, the United States government, and the state governments that allowed them to operate without workers having any rights. This, you know, if this were happening in any other country, we'd be hearing people standing up and screaming bloody murder.
Exactly.
And
yes. I want to just say that at the beginning when I was talking about suicide and alcohol and all, I wasn't trying to be derogatory or anything. I was just saying that there's so many problems, even more on the reservation. And what you're talking about is this is the so-called quote-unquote lucky ones who can actually get to a job on the reservation. I've been talking with a lot of people in Pine Ridge in South Dakota. And they can't even, you know, I mean, they're just stuck. The unemployment rate is something like, depending on who you listen to, 86% to 98%. There's
Here in Minnesota, the poverty, the unemployment rate on the northern Indian reservations is anywhere from 65% to 85%.
Yeah.
And that's with these huge casino operating. And
so, there's no jobs. I mean, and if you do get to the casino, like you said, your hearing's going to go, your lungs are going to go. There's no,
right.
And you have no benefits. So
no,
it's
none
like
at
they,
all.
They,
and for many workers, these casino jobs are their first jobs. Especially a lot of young workers. You have a tremendous amount of the workers in this industry are young women workers. And the effects of secondhand smoke is just horrible on reproductive systems.
Sure.
You know, this is just terrible. If you have diabetes is one of the biggest problems, health problems on Indian reservations. And the doctors and the scientific community all say that secondhand smoke, exacerbates problems associated with diabetes.
Yeah.
We have all these problems, and some of the problems with alcohol and the drugs and everything. The casino industry has made all these problems worse, and I'll tell you why. Because with the casino industry comes all kinds of corruption that is part of the business that nobody wants to talk about. You have these mobsters who own the slot machines. They run prostitution through these casinos. They run their drug dealing through these casinos. They run their loan sharking through these casinos. In other words, the gambler starts running out of money, and the casino managements are right there to hand them more money, even though this is illegal, and people end up losing their entire homes. When I was a blackjack dealer, a guy actually lost his tractor trailer rig playing blackjack within a couple hours. You know, and the tractor trailer rig wasn't even paid for, and yet the casino ended up owning it.
Right,
so,
and he still had to make payments. Yes. I'm very anti-gambling. Sorry. I mean, I guess it's just left over from my childhood because, though, of all the horror stories I've heard. Now, I mean, just like that. He lost his ring.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to gambling myself, although I've never put a penny in a slot machine, and I don't gamble. I just don't, it's not something that I like. you know, I'd rather go out fishing or something. I understand there's people that like to gamble, and they should be able to gamble as far as I'm concerned. You know, if we look to the north in Manitoba, Canada, the province of Manitoba runs their own state-owned casinos, and all the proceeds, instead of going to a bunch of mobsters, the proceeds go to support education and health care. Canadians get
That's
free health care.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, and the casinos are smoke-free, and the noise levels are required to be kept within the requirements of the law, the decibel limits, like in all other industries. So, you know, the workers are protected. They did have smoking in these casinos. And when casino workers from Manitoba got a hold of me and asked what they could do to end the smoke in their casinos, I had discussions with leaders of the Manitoba government, and it wasn't even 3 months before they ended smoking. They said, we've never considered this, you know. But when it was brought to their attention, the New Democratic Party, which was the party in power and still is in Manitoba, they ended it right away. You know, the same thing
amazing?
Could be done here.
That's amazing, what? Though. Government that actually cared about the people? To us that sounds
contrast,
so...
Well, contrast that with the Minnesota legislature and governor. Here we have a supermajority of Democrats in power here in Minnesota. They can do whatever they want. The Republicans have no say. But Democrats and Republicans, prior to their supermajority, got together and passed smoke-free legislation, making all places of employment smoke-free, except for the casinos. They specified that the casinos didn't have to go smoke-free. This is the way these people who created these compacts turn around and treat the casino workers, the 44,000 Minnesotans forced to work in these casinos, these smoke-filled casinos at poverty wages. You know, they talk about jobs, jobs, jobs. This is the largest job-creating program that's ever been created prior to the 1930s, or after the 1930s here in Minnesota. And what kind of jobs have these been? You know, you just have to talk to any casino worker, and you find out that they're poverty wage jobs.
Right.
They're being made miserable as far as their health and welfare. You know, when workers have no rights on the job, they have no rights in their own community. Right now I'm working with a group of workers from the Leech Lake Nation's casinos who have been fired because they posted about their working conditions on their blogs and websites. You know, I had to fight, represent a guy that was fired from the Mystic Lake Casino. That's a huge casino employing around 5,000 people here in Minnesota. And he was fired for posting on his blog about working in the casino there. And they were going to deny him unemployment compensation. You know, we had to fight for his right to get just unemployment compensation. He never got his job back. But the U.S. Department of Labor and the Minnesota Department of Labor will do nothing to enforce wages and hours within these casinos. There are casino workers, blackjack dealers, being paid $5.25 an hour at casinos here in Minnesota right here today.
Okay, I was going to ask.
Flagrantly in violation of the law.
Well, now, are they considered people who get tips? Because I know that at least in this country, I don't know if it still holds, but there were some jobs that people were not paid minimum wage even because they say that they get tips, and that would bring them up to over the minimum wage. But
well, that's the problem. They say that these are tipped workers. In actuality, the tips do not, even with the tips, their wages are not brought up to minimum wage.
Yeah.
Because these aren't casinos like you have in out in east of the big casinos like Foxwoods or the Las Vegas casinos where, you know, people really do win quite a bit of money in these casinos, and the tips are fairly large. At these casinos here in Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan, most of the people, the majority of the people, come out just total losers. So, you know, these aren't people that are going to be tipping dealers or other casino workers.
Right.
So, you know, this is the situation. This is the reality of the situation. People aren't ending up with $20, $25, $30 an hour with their tips like a lot of dealers do in Las Vegas and some of those casinos. I've heard of dealers in Las Vegas making $80-$90 an hour when they can their tips are included. But these aren't those kinds of casinos. These are the kind of casinos where if somebody's out fishing, when they're done fishing for the day, they'll go in and gamble a little bit. You get some of the gamblers, they have gambling problems, but these are very poor people that are thinking they're going to hit it rich or at least get enough money to pay their gas bill or their electric bill. They're not going to be tipping anybody. And, this is what the situation is like here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan.
Well,
I wish John McCarthy of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association would have come on this program to refute the things that I have to say. He's refuted the things that I've had to say on Minnesota Public Radio and other TV and radio programs, but he will never come on a program that I'm on. And, you know, these people, if you look at their site, you said you looked at their site, their website, you know, you see Indians dancing with colorful attire and everything, but there is no mention of the problems that are being caused by Indian gaming. The problems of poverty are much worse today than they were 20 and 30 years ago before gambling began. The Minnesota Indian Gaming Association would have you believe this isn't true. Before, the U.S. military used to be the largest employer of Native Americans. Today, it's these Indian casinos that are the largest employers of Native Americans. I don't want to see anybody go off and join the Army because they can get better wages there, and come back in a body bag. But on the other hand, these are not the kind of jobs that paid what the U.S. military did, and they certainly don't have any of the benefits that went along with those jobs. And, these could be good jobs, just like any other job could be. Every job should be a good job, whether you work at McDonald's or a casino or Walmart. You know, all these jobs should be good jobs. They should be paying real living wages. The minimum wage should be raised to a living wage, and that minimum wage should be enforced, including in the Indian gaming industry. And, but the politicians, when it comes to the Indian gaming industry, what's not stated on the website of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association is that the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association hires 30 lobbyists to bribe the politicians just here in the state of Minnesota. They spend tens of millions of dollars every election cycle bribing these politicians so that this industry is free of any rights for working people and allows and enables these workers in this industry to work under these horrible conditions.
Non-regulated. How do you, because I'm sure that they don't let you meet up with people on casino property or anything, how do you talk with people?
Well, what we've done, we started our organizing campaign back in the early 2000s, around 2003. And what we do is we go into a casino. I get thrown out of these casinos all the time. But I keep going into the casinos. I talk to workers. When I find a worker that's interested, I say, do you have a few friends that work here? And we set up organizing committees. In some of these casinos, we might have 15 or 20 organizing committees. We can't have just one organizing committee because if you get one snitch for management, that wrecks everything.
Right.
So we get small circles of workers that are looking to organize a union, and we teach them what they got to do to make life miserable for management. We are making life miserable for management in this Indian gaming industry. We're costing them a lot of money. There is really no reason why they shouldn't sit down and negotiate contracts with us. In fact, we've had three different tribes, very close to negotiating contracts with us. But one of the big problems has been the AFL-CIO affiliated unions. When we had chair of the White Earth Nation ready to sit down and sign a contract with us, the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO, Ray Waldron, came forward and said, we'll give you a better deal than Mackey and those Reds. And what happened is the Service Employees Union and Unite Here came in and said, we'll give you a contract at $8 an hour. Don't worry about what Mackey and his talk about $25 and $30 an hour. We'll give you a contract at $8 an hour. This is the dirty way that this campaign has been going on. And the reason for this is because the AFL-CIO is in cahoots with the Democrats. With the Democrats getting these tens of millions of dollars out of the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association every election cycle, the Minnesota AFL-CIO and those affiliated unions consider us a threat to them continuing to get all this these campaign contributions.
Okay.
Right now we got a casino going up here, a brand new casino in War Road where I live. Tens of millions of dollars are being put into this casino, and some people are claiming that it's union labor. Some of it is union labor, and the reasoning is that union workers, people paying workers paying union dues, are working on building this casino. But there is no contract. There is no signed contract between the tribes or the general contractor and any union, which makes it blatantly illegal for these unions to be taking dues, knowing that there is no signed contract nor any intent to obtain a signed contract. This would be blatantly illegal in any other industry. But because they have this whole thing about sovereignty, they're supposedly allowed to do this, you know. And actually what these union workers are doing is buying jobs. They're paying union dues to buy themselves a job. They're not being protected on the job by a union contract. And
right.
At one casino south of here, the Mille Lacs Band operates the Grand Casino, and these building trades unions actually made an agreement that they would prevent any other unions from trying to organize casino workers if they could have union workers on the job, and yet they never had any signed contract and never tried to obtain a signed contract. And when I asked who was looking after the so-called agreement that they had, I was told the general management company on the construction site. Whoever heard of the management firm supposedly looking after the rights of working people rather than union stewards and business agents and business managers from these building trades unions?
It's absurd. They're on different sides.
Exactly. And this is what's going on. And it's a terrible situation all the way around. Guys get hurt on these construction projects on these casinos, and they get no workers' compensation or anything. They're just stuck. Some of them have had to file for bankruptcy because they've been hurt so bad on the jobs, and the medical care that they require has been so expensive. The tribes don't pay to take care of them. The workers' compensation will not pay. So, you know, they're stuck with this themselves. And this is what goes on. It's a very terrible industry. There's nothing else like it here in the United States. Nothing. You know, there's bad working conditions in other places in the world, but there's nothing like what we have here, where government is actually using the levers of government to assure that workers have no rights and that they live in poverty and get poverty wages.
Right, and that these mobsters are just thriving. And they're in the like you said, it goes way back to when we were thrown out of Cuba, so they go to where the people are the most vulnerable.
Exactly.
And set up.
They do studies. You know, one casino, the Grand Casino in Hinckley, Minnesota, owned by the Mille Lacs Band, had a huge billboard up: "Come on and win, get enough money to pay your electric bills and your heating bills." This is supposed
that
to be blatantly illegal advertising on the part of these casinos. And it took us months to get them to take that billboard down, you know. But this is the way these outfits operate. And the Minnesota Heart and Lung Foundation actually had a billboard paid by the casino management talking about the dangers of secondhand smoke. Just like the Leech Lake Band, of Ojibwe has billboards up all over their reservation about how there's the sacred circle of life that is broken as a result of the health problems from people smoking, and yet they will not stop smoking in their own casinos. A top person in the Indian Health Service told me that he considered smoking in these casinos to be just like the way these smallpox infested blankets were handed out here in North and South Dakota, back in the 1800s, to carry out the genocide. And these casinos are part of this campaign of genocide, actually. They're, you know, it's called the Indian gaming industry, like I said, but Indians don't get any of the profits. There's a few Native Americans that they select to be management people, and they're getting, you know, like on the Red Lake Reservation, the top guy in gaming is a Native American, and he gets, you know, a couple $100,000 a year salary. But most of the people get poverty wages is what it amounts to. Even lower levels of management, you know, I'm representing a woman that was fired from her job at the Leech Lake Casino. It's she was only making around $14 an hour for a job that in any other industry would probably be paying $40 to $50 an hour, and she'd be making, you know, easily $80,000 or $90,000 a year in any other industry. And so,
look,
you know, this is the way people are being literally robbed and exploited.
Yeah. What's the percentage of Native people that gamble at the casinos, and the percentage of non-Native? About.
Well, the majority of the gamblers are non-Native, just like the majority of the workers are non-Native, simply because the Natives are a small minority of the population.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, one thing I should point out is that what's really bad here in Minnesota is a very racist state. The city of Bemidji here in northern Minnesota is known as the most racist city in North America. And there are three large Indian reservations surrounding the city of Bemidji, Minnesota: the Red Lake Nation, the Leech Lake Nation, and the White Earth Nation. And it's almost impossible to find a Native American working at Walmarts or Menards or any of these other stores. And this is why they're able to get Native Americans to work so cheaply in these casinos, because of the racism in the employment practices of all the other businesses in the area. So, there's no other opportunity. That's the casinos,
right,
or the military.
So, yeah, they absolutely can't. And then there's the Natives who are too far away on the res. They have no transportation. They would like to work there even for hardly any wages, but they can't get there. There's so much going on that...
Well, that's another problem we've been fighting. The casinos have buses and vans that will transport workers, like from the Red Lake Nation over to Thief River Falls, which is about 100 miles away.
Mm.
But the problem is, people spend like 4 to 5 hours a day riding the bus back and forth, and they don't get paid for any of this.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is another problem. And it's just problem after problem associated with these casinos. There's, you know, people will make excuses for it, but there are really no excuses. It's a very corrupt industry, and it's going to continue that way until these compacts are opened and changed. I met with Governor Jennifer Granholm when she was the governor of Michigan, when they were talking about this Gun Lake Casino. And she says, "What do you want me to do?" I said, "It's very simple. You're negotiating a compact right now. Insert in that compact that casino workers have the same rights as all other workers under state or federal labor laws." And she would not agree to take that position. You know, all she had to do was say, "We're not giving you a permit unless you give casino workers the same rights under state and federal labor laws that all the workers have."
Yep.
This was another Democratic governor. She refused to do that. She essentially kicked me out of her office when I suggested that she do that. We had the problem when the hearings were being held for the Gun Lake Casino. The head of the UAW's, their chief lobbyist, she told me that the UAW would be taking a position supporting the rights of casino workers to be placed in the compact to have the same rights that all other workers have. She pulled a real dirty deal on us. When she went to the hearing, they were given the lobbyists have little cards that they sign with the outlining the various controversies and stuff, and they have little boxes that you may put a check in whether you support like this compact or don't support it. She placed her check right between the two boxes, so her vote didn't even count. And, you know, she lied to me. She talked to me. We both talked on the telephone a number of times for many hours, and she assured me that the UAW would be taking a position that casino workers, their rights would be included in this compact to include the same rights all their workers have. When it came for her chance to voice the UAW's position on this, she put her check in the middle so her card didn't even count. And she tried to lie to me and tell me that that wasn't true, that she had put her check in the right box. And I was sent a copy of the card, which clearly showed that her mark was, you know, right in the middle between the two boxes. These are the kind of dirty things that have been going on in this industry and with our organizing campaign. I come across people wearing these union leaders, big union leaders. I came across a group of UAW leaders. These are people that work for Solidarity House. They were sitting in the casino, the Odawa Casino in Petoskey, Michigan, with their UAW jackets on and everything. And I went up to them and I said, "What are you doing?" And I was, "Oh, hi, Al. How are you?" I said, "Well, I'm doing pretty good, but, you know, we're trying to organize this casino, and you're well aware of it." I said, "And here you sit putting your money into these slot machines?" Oh, they said, "Oh, you know, we're just having a little fun." And I said, "Yeah, you know, at the expense of the casino workers." And, you know, they laughed and thought it was funny. I pulled out my camera, and I said, "Well, if you don't get up and leave this casino right now, I'm taking your picture, and I'm going to put it all over the Internet." You know, it wasn't 2 minutes, and they got up and left. You know, a dozen of these guys that were going to the UAW Education Center over in Black Lake, they got up and left the casino because they knew the results of having their picture placed on the Internet sitting in this casino.
Yeah, I mean, so we're just dealing with hypocrites everywhere. And you know, them sitting in there and, "Oh, we're just having a little fun, you know, throwing some money in the slots, having a drink or so." I mean, this is the same thing as someone who knowingly buys something made in Bangladesh or something. You know.
Speaking of the sweatshops in Bangladesh, these casinos, they have gift shops. And if you walk into the gift shops, you'll see big signs that say, handcrafted Native American crafts. But if you look at the boxes this stuff comes in, you'll see labels from India, Bangladesh, Pakistan, the Philippines, Mexico, you know. So even when it comes to the gift shops, what they tout is Native American crafts aren't even Native American crafts. So in this way, Native American craftspeople are being denied the right to make a living. You know,
right.
They could be making a pretty decent living through these gift shops and the casinos, but the casinos are buying all this crap and all these sweatshops manufactured all over the world, where the people are probably treated much worse than the people in the Indian game, than the workers in the Indian gaming industry. And yet, you know, this is what goes on. There are federal laws that stipulate that it's against the law to mark an item as Native American handmade crafts, which come from, you know, other being manufactured in other places,
right,
by other people. And this is a flagrant violation. When the chair of the Leech Lake Nation was elected during the last election, Kerry Price, I was in a meeting discussing poverty at a church, at a Methodist church in Cass Lake, Minnesota, and I brought this up. And she says, "I don't believe you that this is going on." And there was a guy at the meeting and says, "We're taking a group of people over to the casino and we're going to see what's going on there." And they found all this stuff that was being made in all these sweatshops overseas. And, I mean, people were very, very mad and angry that this was going on.
My God.
The Leech Lake Nation now has the highest minimum wage in the country of any state or the federal government. They have a $10.25 minimum wage because we've been pushing so hard on how cost of living and wages have to be related. And so the people of the Leech Lake Nation have been fighting like heck, and now casino workers have a $10.25 minimum wage on the Leech Lake Nation. But this has taken over 10 years of organizing an effort to achieve this little bit of progress. You know,
right.
And here in Minnesota, the governor of the state and the Democrats, they won't even implement a minimum wage of $9.50 an hour. So,
yeah.
You know, and the labor unions are supporting a minimum wage of $9.50, and then you have somebody like this state senator Tom Bach, who was a big shot in the building trades unions. he's pushing for a state minimum wage of $7.75 an hour. You know, pathetic. And this is largely because the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association's lobbyists, they're the biggest voice for the employers when it comes to keeping the minimum wage a poverty wage here in Minnesota. So once again, this shows, you know, how these people operate.
Right. They don't think, well, I shouldn't be surprised, but I was surprised when you said that about the items in the gift store are made elsewhere, because I always thought that they were, you know, crafted on the res, like it says, but I figured that the crafters were getting, like, nothing, was what I thought, because it would be like maybe a non-native person running the store, you know, the trading post or whatever. So I thought that they were probably paying the natives little of nothing to make this, but I really did not understand that it was coming from Asia, most of these things.
Yeah, it's worse than what it even seems. And there's a lot of very talented native craftspeople that painting and other artwork and beadwork what they make at, and if it were sold at the same prices, they would be making, you know, a very good income. And but, you know, they're getting this junk from out of the sweatshops in Asia, and you know, they might pay 15 cents for something that they're selling for $25 or $30.
Yeah. So there's just no, and like you said, even to get this minimum wage up to $10.25 has taken like 10 years of organizing. How did you yourself, Alan? I want to say we're talking with Alan Mackey. From the podunkblog.blogspot.com, or just Google Alan Mackey, M-A-K-I, how did you get involved in the native fight? Because you grew up, your parents were communists, you were the youngest card-carrying member of the party in quite an area,
Michigan,
when you were 17. Yeah.
So,
but how did you get involved in with the Native Americans?
Well, I was introduced to a guy named Roger Jourdain way back in the 1970s. Roger Jourdain had been the chair of the Red Lake Nation for almost 30 years. And as the result of our friendship and the relationship that we developed, I did a lot of writing and research for him. And he was a big promoter of the bingo, the tribes using bingo to get revenues and stuff. But when it came to the casinos, he was one of the first people, one of the first leaders in the Indian nations to recognize that if Indians did not own the slot machines, they were not going to make anything as a result of Indian gaming. And when he came out in opposition to Indian gaming, the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association stepped in, and they libeled and maligned him like you wouldn't believe. They made him out to look like the worst kind of crook around, when he literally, the people of the Red Lake Nation were literally living in nothing but tar paper shacks for decades after the treaties were signed. And once he became chair of the Red Lake Nation, one of the first projects that he did was to establish a lumber mill where they made wood to build the people brand new homes. The people did not have to pay a single penny interest to banks or anything for these homes. You know, the homes on the Red Lake Nation are some of the best homes that people live in any reservation. But now, you know, the homes are coming in disrepair because of the casino industry. The mills that they had are shut down and not in use. People are not getting new homes to keep up with the population. But myself and Roger Jourdain went to talk to Rudy Perpich in the late 1980s. Rudy Perpich was the governor of Minnesota, and he was very pro-labor. And we sat down with him at a little park called Mesaba Co-op Park near Hibbing, Minnesota, for a weekend. And we explained the situation to Rudy Perpich, and he agreed with us that he wanted to see workers' rights included in these compacts because, you know, Roger Jourdain told him, and Roger Jourdain had been a member of a union himself. He worked in the building trades on construction. And he told them, Indian people aren't going to get anything out of these casinos because we're not going to own the slot machines, so we got to at least have living wages. And that's going to require unionization of the casino workers. Rudy Perpich agreed with that. He went to then Attorney General of Minnesota, Skip Humphrey, the son of Hubert H. Humphrey, and Skip Humphrey told him, no way. We have the opportunity to get far too much in the way of campaign contributions out of this industry to go along with anything like that. So Roger Jourdain was run out of office. His own friends, they worked against him, and the Minnesota Indian Gaming Association paid these people to work against him. They paid them to malign him, and they got him out. And after they got him out, they went full bore into this Indian gaming industry here in Minnesota. And, that's how I became involved.
Okay. So it actually started with a friendship.
Right. And doing some research and writing for him, speeches and things like that.
And your background, because you had, you grew up with people from the party that were hiding and people from the party that were being taken to court. And, you knew a lot of people, or you met when you were young.
I members of my family were very prominent in the labor union in Michigan, including in the Flint sit-down strike. One of my uncles was the director of education for the Flint and Saginaw region of the UAW. He was ousted from the union, and he was actually ended up being killed. He was beaten up 1 week and killed the next week. He was beaten up by Walter Reuther's thugs, who were very anti-communist in Flint, Michigan, and a week or so later, he ended up getting killed. But, I've come up in this a family of activists, of labor activists, of peace activists. My mother took me around in a little wagon when I was a baby. I don't remember it, but she was fighting for the freedom for the Rosenbergs. And, there's literally thousands of working class families like my own family that have been involved in these struggles. And they faced massive government repression as a result of their involvement.
Yeah.
We don't hear about this too much in this country anymore. I was just talking to somebody. In fact, I posted on Facebook today and on my blog about the issue of cost of living. There's a lot of talk about economic inequality in this country and the whole situation around the minimum wage being a poverty wage. But none of these labor leaders want to talk about the relationship between wages and cost of living. And as we were talking, we thought about this and we said, the old union organizers back in the 1930s and into the 1940s, if you look at any of their old leaflets and newspapers and magazines, the one thing they always talked about was what can you buy with your wages? This was the way to mobilize the working class in order to get people to fight for better working conditions and better wages. Today, you will never hear somebody like Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, talk about cost of living and wages. The reason for that is because all these unions are negotiating concession contracts. And if you're negotiating a concession contract, the last thing you want to talk about is the relationship between wages and cost of living. We have a guy here in Minnesota, the head of AFSCME, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, a guy named Elliot Seed. He's become a millionaire off the labor movement. He will not talk about cost of living and the minimum wage. He is trying to shove a $9.50 minimum wage down the throats of all other workers. How would he like it if casino workers came or any other workers came and said, why don't you state workers take $9.50 an hour for your wages?
Yeah.
These people would not like us saying that. We don't expect them to try and shove another poverty wage down our throats. And, this is something that's been lost in the labor movement, and it's been lost because, quite frankly, people that talk like I do, Reds and communists and socialists, have literally been tossed out of the labor movement.
Right.
My entire life, I've had to, work under pseudonyms and everything else in different unions because I would have been fired. In fact, George Meany and Lane Kirkland tried to place the Kent County Labor Council under trusteeship when they hired me to work for them. And because they said that, you know, we're not going to allow a communist to work for any AFL-CIO-affiliated union. And this is what people have faced. So as a result, we have unions today that are negotiating all these concessionary contracts at a time when profits are higher than ever before. This is absurd. And it's happened because nobody will talk about the relationship between cost of living and wages. And this is one thing that really scares these labor leaders here in Minnesota. When myself and other members of our union organizing committee are going around talking to casino workers about the relationship between what you can buy with your wages, cost of living, and wages. Because they know that these workers are going to go talk to a lot of other people, you know, and those people are going to say, hey, you know, why aren't our labor leaders talking like this?
Right. Well, that was, I had been going to ask you about if you had found some kind of, what do I want to say, being a communist, if you had been discriminated against, and so sometimes you were then. That was
by government and employers, and so-called
also,
union leaders. Let me tell you this story. I met with Ray Waldron, who was the president of the Minnesota AFL-CIO at the time. We met in his office. We had a conversation for about probably 4 to 5 hours, and he kept telling me, "I'm not going to allow a bunch of Reds to take over the Minnesota AFL-CIO." He says, "I don't care if the Reds are communists or if they're Indians." This was his attitude. And I brought this up to John Sweeney when I met with John Sweeney, who was the president, the national president of the AFL-CIO. I brought this up to him at a meeting in Washington, and he pretty much just laughed about it. You know, rather than taking action to stop this guy from making these kinds of racist and anti-communist remarks and dealing with a legitimate organizing campaign going on, he laughed about it and did nothing.
Well, now now you're talking about Minnesota, and I had learned from you that Minnesota actually was very racist as far as blacks and it is not all land of 10,000 lakes. I mean, there's a lot going on there. And your own family, you left with your family and moved to Canada for a while because of it.
Yeah, I didn't. Well, I wasn't living in Minnesota at the time. I was actually born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, and lived there most of my life.
Okay.
And I ended up coming to live here in Minnesota because of this organizing campaign. Roger Jourdain asked me to come and get involved in this organizing campaign in the Indian gaming industry. So I was working on a campaign organizing Lillian Vernon, a sweatshop down in Virginia Beach, Minnesota. Virginia Beach, Virginia. And I came from Virginia Beach to Minnesota to work on this organizing campaign at his request. And I would say, you know, our family left Michigan because our children were literally shot at by this group associated with the Michigan Militia, these very vicious right-wing organization. As a result of my writing an article against Ronald Reagan, they took it out of my, my kids were only like 8 and 9 years old when these five guys pulled up with shotguns and opened up fire on them.
Oh, heaven.
The state police Michigan State Police caught these guys, and they laughed about it. They said left-wing violence versus right-wing violence. We were just lucky these guys were such cowards. They didn't take the time to aim. So my kids were never hit while they were waiting for their school bus. But it so scared the school bus driver who was just driving up when they opened the fire. We had a hard time making the school stop at our house to pick up our kids. They wanted us to bring our kids almost a mile away from our home. And we had a whole fight over that. And this is the way, government has operated with, repression against the left. The state cops actually laughed that this happened to my kids. One of the cops that thought it was so funny, he ended up in a shootout in Fremont, Michigan, with one of the same guys that they had apprehended for shooting my kids and did nothing about. He ended up in a shootout with some other cops with the same group of guys, and the guy from the Michigan Militia was killed. One state cop was killed, and another state cop was wounded in the shootout. Then it wasn't so funny anymore.
No. I mean, it's not funny that people were killed, but you wanted to see karma kicking somebody's butt. I mean, that was – we don't see it that often. So, yeah, exactly. He thought it was funny when it was your children being shot at, but then the very same person, wow.
Yeah.
No.
My kids still live in Canada. They never want to come back here to this country, what they were put through. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, you know, you can talk about being shot at and stuff, but my son was out on the end of the driveway waiting for the school bus, and he was just lucky that he could, he saw the guys coming with the guns, and he ducked behind an old pickup truck I had sitting there, and my daughter was just getting ready to go out the door, and all the shooting started, and I grabbed her and dragged her back inside, and I mean, she was in hysterics for hours. Even when she saw her little brother, she thought that her little brother was dead because of all the shooting. It was just like a war, the way these guys, five guys, opened up fire with these semi-automatic shotguns on our house. And we were lucky. All the pellets went into the top of our house and the roof rather than hitting the kids because these cowards, you know, we were lucky that they were such cowards. They wouldn't take the time to aim. And, you know, that's the only thing that saved my kids is their cowardice.
Yeah, that's so traumatic. And at such a young age, I don't blame them for not coming back. It's like, well, it's Canada, so you can still see them frequently.
Can't go to Canada. I was deported from Canada, and Canada has barred me for life from reentering Canada. I had written some articles against racism against Native people in Canada, and one night the RCMP and Canada Immigration came knocking on our door and shoved the articles. Literally, the guy from the RCMP took the articles and shoved them right up into my nose and said, we don't need a communist telling us that we mistreat Indians here in Canada. And we had a big fight there trying to stop the deportation. We fought the deportation for almost 2 years. And finally, the Minister of Immigration, she told me, come to Toronto and let's see if we can resolve this. And the only thing that they would accept is that if I left Canada, my kids would be allowed to stay.
Wow. Okay, one of these days, you have the time because you're so busy, but, you know, you better start writing some of your memoirs because you've got stories. My God, man. It's been interesting, huh? And it's getting even more interesting.
But, you know, a lot of people have these same kind of stories to tell. I mean, the struggles that are taking place across Canada and the United States, I don't think people really realize what's going on in this country today, the way people are fighting for their rights. The media and everything, if you watch television, listen to radio, read the newspapers, you never hear about any of these struggles. For instance, with our struggle to organize casino workers, not one single newspaper, because one newspaper did report on it, the Ojibwe News that was published by Bill Lawrence, who had been a professional baseball player. He covered it quite thoroughly. But with that exception, no newspaper, no radio station, and no television station has ever reported on the conditions of casino workers in this Indian gaming industry here in Minnesota, Wisconsin, or Michigan. And there's a reason for that. If you pick up any newspaper, if you listen to a radio station, if you watch a television station, what do you see? One of the main things that are advertised, casinos. Come win big in our casinos. And these people are not going to jeopardize their advertising revenue to publish an article about how casino workers are treated.
They're not going to do it. Alan, we're going to have to let you go. I hope you'll come back. This is so interesting. And like you say, people are not getting this from mainstream media in any form. So they really don't know what's going on.
Why I appreciate this opportunity.
People go to an Indian casino and they think, well, all this money is going toward the Indians. And like you said, 85% off the top goes to the mob. And then, you know, then there's still trickle down. I mean, it's not like I even get 15%, so that's just horrid. But Alan Mackey, the Podunk blog at blogspot.com, or just Google DuckDuckGo or search him out, Alan Mackey. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yes, you are always welcome, and you're always full of interesting things to make us think. So I appreciate it.
Okay. Good night.
Good night. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And in our second hour, we have Ole Damgaard, who is in Spain. I have to tell you, this has been pre-recorded. We were going to run it or air it the other week, and we had his previous one. We were in Mercury retrograde, and it was all messed up, but this is the right one. So here's Ole. Hello again, and welcome to Feed Your Head. Tonight we have back Ole Damgaard, and I'm Damgaard, I'm so sorry, Ole. And his website is lightonconspiracies.com. This man is fascinating. He has spent almost three decades researching facts. So, Ole, I'm so glad to have you back.
The honor is mine.
And we only touched you mentioned, but we couldn't get into it last time, Operation 40. And as I told you, I'm not sure if I'd ever even heard of it until you mentioned it. If I had, it hadn't clicked. But do you want to tell us, what is Operation 40?
I tell you, you're not the only one who hadn't heard it, because it used to be a super secret group that was, if I go back in history, it was a group that was created under the surveillance of President Dwight Eisenhower. He, at that time, they had a lot of problems with Fidel Castro had just overtaken Cuba, and they wanted to get rid of the beard. They were really eager to get rid of him. So he gave his vice president, Richard Nixon, the task of putting together a special team of assassins. This started out with between 40 and 80 people, most of them exiled Cubans that had been in the military, air force, or police force under Fidel Castro and Batista on Cuba, and then had escaped from Cuba and came to Miami. And there they were recruited by people from the CIA, who was put in charge of this group. The aim was to put together a very lethal weapon that could be used against other international leaders and presidents or whatever enemy that they had problems with. So they were trained in all kinds of assassinations. They were trained with explosives, with you name it, any type of way to eliminate people. And like I said, they were... In the beginning, they were aimed at Fidel Castro, and they made several attempts on his life. But then when suddenly after the Cuban Missile Crisis, when Kennedy came to a point where he was sitting with a finger on the button, almost being the one that started a world nuclear atomic war, I think that was like a wake-up call for JFK, who at that point had not really understood what he was really... the name of the game on what was on at stake, you know. And after that, where people who were there said that he sat with tears in his eyes and with a finger more or less at the button and just saying, I refuse to be the one that does this to the world. After that point, suddenly he started from being a very easily maneuvered president that the military complex and the global elite could sort of push around the way they wanted it. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, he became a very, very strong individual who was who aimed at. You know, he wanted to crush the CIA in 1,000 pieces. He wanted to dismantle the Federal Reserve and get the money printed interest free for the people to get out of this strangulation that this super illegal Federal Reserve is putting on the American people. And internationally as well. He wanted to withdraw from the Vietnam War and so on. There were many, many different reasons why they wanted him out. So this Operation 40 was aimed, they aimed this cannon at Kennedy instead. and he was in Dealey Plaza that day. It was just filled with members from this Operation 40. I can go into great detail if you want, where many of the people in the assassination team were members from this team, combined with people from the mafia, from the Secret Service, the well,
big name people,
massive people. And one thing that is really very important to point out as well is that the person that they put in charge of the funding of this group, the guy who funneled the money from oil tycoons in Texas, the oil barons from the military-industrial complex, from different big corporations who were thrown out from Cuba and also having big problems with Kennedy. The man that was put in charge to do that was a young man by the name of George Herbert Walker Bush, who came from, his father was Prescott Bush, who was the guy who funded Hitler and other sides. He was almost charged with treason for doing that, but he was just the elite's money guy who was doing that. And Prescott Bush was also the one that got Dwight Eisenhower up in the where he got elected for president. He was also the mentor for Nixon and so on. So these people have been following each other long before these events that happened later on. So George Bush Sr. was actually the paymaster of this group, and he was in Dealey Plaza as well. He was inside the Deltex building when the shots were fired, together with one shooter, one spotter, and Johnny Rosselli, who was the middleman between the mob and the government and the elite, the Chicago mob.
Right.
So...
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, so in this group, we had these very skilled killers. Like I say, most of them were exiled Cubans. And then they were controlled and maneuvered by a group of people from the CIA. There were people like Ted Shackley. He was also known as the Blonde Ghost. Super central in assassinations all over the place, all over the globe. Super, super central. We had E. Howard Hunt, who was the same. He was one of these his colleagues, and also he pops up everywhere. He was also the leader of the burglars in the Watergate burglary, where they were trying to get rid of evidence that connected Nixon to the Kennedy assassination. That was the reason for that burglary. Then you had another man called David Atlee Phillips, who was he was later the top chief for the CIA for the Western Hemisphere when it came to black operations, dirty trick operation and propaganda. And this David Atlee Phillips, he went under several different aliases. He was known as Howard Benson. Morris Bishop was another name. But this guy was actually the handler, you know, the controller, the CIA controller, of Lee Harvey Oswald, the pointed out patsy for the killing of JFK. But he was also the handler of James Files, who was the shooter at the grassy knoll behind the picket fence. There was a whole range of shooters in Dealey Plaza this day. He was caught in triangular fire between different firing teams. I can name them all if you want later on. But James Files was the one who had confessed to firing the final headshot from the right front, just behind the picket fence, and he was the controller, and that he was also later the controller of a man called Michael Vernon Townley, who became a very sinister assassin who was used in big time in Operation Condor, where they were overtaking Salvador Allende in Chile. With Operation Condor, later they tracked down and killed a lot of exiled Chilean politicians and people that was anti the Pinochet regime that the elite had put there instead. And this team in Dealey Plaza moved around doing, like they blew up Orlando Letier in Washington, D.C., in Embassy Row. There was a car bomb there that blew up. The bomb was supplied by an exiled Cuban from the Operation 40. His name was Orlando Bosch. He was responsible for hundreds and hundreds of these bomb terror acts over the years. And finally, in the end, after being put to prison, he was pardoned by no one else than George Herbert Walker Bush. The bomb to that, it was supplied by James Files. Now we're talking about this bombing in Washington, D.C. of Orlando Letier. The bomb was supplied by James Files, who was the shooter in Dealey Plaza. And the other people who were part of that assassination was part of the, they were in Dallas that day as well. Then you have a man called David Morales. He was way up there in the CIA. He was in Dealey Plaza, very, very violent person who was, he was later called the head hitman in South America, Latin America. And he was, like I say, in Dealey Plaza. He was also at the Ambassador Hotel, being part of the group that took out Robert Kennedy years later. He was also the guy who, he was actually the guy who shot Che Guevara and killed him in Bolivia. The guy who was in charge of that operation, chasing down Che Guevara, who was one of, which I would say, a colleague of Fidel Castro, the guy who was in charge of that operation was a man by the name of Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez is super central in the Iran-Contras affair scandal, where he was working side by side with Oliver North. So he was the one tracking down Che Guevara and ordered the killing. But Felix Rodriguez was also George Herbert Walker Bush right hand when it came to funding Operation 40, right from the beginning in the very early 1960s, and continuing way up. I mean, many of these people, of these members, if they're not dead, some of them are still active to this very day, you know, up in their 70s and 80s.
That was what amazed me. You said before, when you were on, that it's like these people don't retire. I mean, they... Tell me, Ole, because I can't seem to get it. Now, I do understand, even though I don't agree, but when they started out with exiled Cubans who were not happy with Castro, but being a fan of, the revolution and all there, I would disagree with them, but they were there, and so they had their own beef. So they were in Miami, but... they were recruited then by the CIA, but then other people came in, and some of these men, I mean, they must just be evil kinds of people, because, I mean, they continued. It wasn't like just for one cause. It wasn't just one thing. The Operation 40 people tried in many different guises to assassinate Fidel Castro, and it never worked. But it wasn't just that, because they branched out, just like you're saying, with Kennedy's assassination, South America, they got involved in Chile. I mean, they were just bitter, mean people somehow. Am I right? Or were they being blackmailed? Did they actually believe in what they were doing? Were they doing it for money? What kept this organization going?
I tell you, I think they were just... skilled people, you know, and their business was death, and they were used because they were very good at what they were doing. They were disciplined. They were trustworthy. Some of them had a high moral codex, if you can say that. You know, they saw. I think many of them have seen themselves as freedom fighters, even though I can't really see what the glory of being a freedom fighter if you blow up a Cuban airliner killing 73 innocent people. I can't see the honor in doing things like that, but they themselves have seen themselves as men of honor and so on. So it's just a very twisted way of seeing it, in my opinion. But the reason why they've been used over and over again is just because they've been really good at what they're doing.
Right. Okay, that and they're willing because like
And also, sorry if I interrupt you, but the problem was that in the early 1960s they were going to invade Cuba, and the whole operation was they were trained very hard for this invasion. And it came to this very famous Bay of Pigs fiasco, where they tried to invade the Cuba, but right at the point where they were waiting for air support, the air support was called on standby. They were withdrawn. So these people, these freedom fighters, were left on their own, and many of them murdered and tortured to death and killed on the streets and put as prisoners and so on. And these exiled Cubans blamed Kennedy, JFK, for having been the one who canceled the air support. And for that, they hated the guy. They really hated him. So that was why they wanted to take him out big time. So they were very easy to persuade to take part in that assassination.
Okay. That makes sense, because that they took very personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Then, but after that, they've been used, you know, they were used in parts of hit on the Dominican Republic, the president there. They were part in, some of them were in Rhodesia, in South Africa. They, like this Michael Van Townley I mentioned before, he's part in a big political assassination in South Africa by a man called Robert Smith. He and his wife were murdered there. They tried to kill a man, a Chilean exile in Italy, Bernard Layton, when his wife, they were shot down. They both survived, though. And they just kept on. And this Michael Van Townley was actually present in Stockholm as well when the Swedish Prime Minister was shot down 23 years after Dealey Plaza. And, you know, like if you go in Dealey Plaza, for instance, like I say, I can name the most of the shooters, but also there's this, do you know the Black Umbrella Man? There was one guy in Dealey Plaza with a black umbrella, and there's been a lot of speculations why on a sunny day was somebody standing where with a black umbrella. Somebody has said that it was this was a secret weapon that he could shoot arrows with and so on. But the reason why he was standing there was to show the point where the crossfire should take place. You know, since there were so many different shooters, they couldn't have it, since they were going to blame them on one single patsy. They couldn't have people shooting all over the place. So it was like, everybody shoot now. You know, that's why they positioned him right there. His name, as far as I've been able to find out, was Roy Hargraves, who was closely connected. He wasn't really a participant in Operation 40, but he was closely connected. And the guy in front of him, he was standing waving. Sometimes he's called the waving guy. His name was Felipe Vidal Santiago, also close connected to Operation 40. And this Felipe went under the name of Charles Morgan for many years. He worked for a CIA cover company called ITT. And one of the tasks he had for years and years was to recruit new assassins for local hits in whatever country he was in. And in 1985, this Charles Morgan was trying to recruit assassins in Stockholm to take part of the hit on Olof Palme. So we have people, direct connections from Dealey Plaza, going through the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles, taking out Robert Kennedy, killing Che Guevara. They took out Paolo Neruda, the Nobel Prize winning poet in Chile as well. You got Uwe Barsel in West Germany and the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme. So they're all connected. And then you got other members like Porto Goss, who was later, not many years ago, was appointed the chief of the head of the CIA under George Bush. You know, so these people, I think it's very important to understand that these white-haired guys that comes on TV from the White House and these other places, they didn't just come from pop up from no absolute nowhere. Many of them have been active, very active, for years and years and years. and have come to that level just because they have dipped their hands in blood and they have been loyal to the cause,
right.
And that's where they are now.
I think
it's crucial to understand that the people in so-called power at this point are super, super, super criminal, and they do not want the population's best, the absolute contrary. So it's time to take the power back.
Yeah. Well, that these people then they've that old phrase made their bones. I mean that's what they did that long ago. Now was Operation 40 by that name, and then Operation 7, was that one of the biggest or earliest CIA operations?
No, God, no. The CIA was actually created under the name of OSS, and the OSS was created by a lot of former Nazis, you know, that was exported. Do you know after the Second World War when the Nazi war machine were defeated officially? We thought, oh, thank God, now the threat is over, and we can relax. The thing was, these Nazis, a few of them were sentenced just for, so you know, like a theater for the crowd, but most of them were imported. They exported them from Germany, Nazi Germany, into America and South America, where they were building up the OSS. Alan Dulles, the former chief of the CIA, he was part of Operation Paperclip, where they got all of these super Nazis out of the Nazi Germany into the States and other places, and then built up the CIA. They also built up NASA and other very crucial companies like that with super Nazis and the banking system, and they just infiltrated the whole thing. And also they used these people to train these assassins, like some of the first members of the Operation 40 and so on. They were trained by former Nazi officers, high-ranking officers. And also the whole Stay Behind Gladio movement, the Ghost Army, I don't know if you're aware of that, but which is built up in all NATO countries, in Europe and other places as well. Were built up with the help of people like Richard Gehlen, a high-ranking SS officer, and so on. So,
what is that, the Ghost Armory?
Stay Behind. Stay Behind is a very, very important piece in the job to understand, in the pixel puzzle to understand about. It was in 1947, after the Second World War, where the NSC and the National Security Council, they decided to build a ghost army in all NATO countries. It was supposed to be like a guerrilla movement, an underground guerrilla movement, so that if any country in the NATO alliance would be invaded, at that time it was the threat came from the east, but if the country would be invaded, there would be a secret resistance army already in place. So what they did was that they made thousands of small groups of 8 to 10 people with hidden guns, with hidden fuel depots, food, radio equipment, all of these things spread out in all these countries, so that if the country got invaded, the leadership of that country could just be transported to London, and then the whole resistance would already be in place. So it was an excellent idea.
Okay.
The thing was just that it didn't take that long before the Russian threat wasn't there anymore, and then they had this massive army that nobody knew about, that were already in place. So what they came up with was this idea of, they call it the strategy of tension. What they used this army for was to start inflicting fear into normal society. They are responsible for every single one of these so-called terror acts that I've been able to look into. You can track back to this Gladio network. It's they blew up the train stations, they shot people in supermarkets, mass shootings. They've done this for years and years, the whole idea was to get the population in these different countries to go into fear mode and accept more and more right-wing political rule,
right,
and ask for a more and more militant police, a police state, you know, please protect us
right,
from all of these terrorists. They're everywhere. No, they're not. They're from the inside. And many of these assassins that are being used internationally are being picked from this Stay Behind network. Officially, this Stay Behind movement doesn't exist anymore, but I think that is absolute BS. You know, they are there. Maybe they changed names, but they're still there, and they're active to this very day.
Yeah, it would be very naive to think that they aren't there, because we've learned that once some kind of an operation like that is established, it doesn't disappear. But sure, they could have changed their names, but the goal is still the same.
It is. They, you know, in every single operation, they call them something else. You know, it's called G2 or ZR rifle or Operation 40. Operation 40 has been named the grandmother of all Black Ops.
Oh.
You know, so that is sort of like the first real one, it's the one that has been like a template that has been used ever since.
Right, right. So that's where it behooves us to find out about it, because it was like, well, the biggie, like you say, it's a template, and so the people from there. I mean, maybe they say they're not called Operation 40 or Operation 70 or anything like that anymore, but they're still there. Like you're talking, these white-haired men in their 70s and 80s, they're still active.
Yes, some of them are still active. And I know, I mean, there are even, sculptures or statues in Miami of some of them. You got one statue of one of the guys. His name was Nestor Izquierdo. And as far as I know, he was the spotter in the Deltex building from where some of the shots were fired at Kennedy. From the shooter in that building, you know, you have the school book depository, first the Deltex building, then the school book depository, and then the grassy knoll, and then the three bridge underway, or whatever you call it, the bridge there, surrounding Dealey Plaza. And in the Deltex building, this is, as far as I've been able to find out, the shooter was a hitman from the Chicago mob called Chucky Nicoletti, who was there together with a CIA, the liaison between the Chicago mob, the government, and the CIA. His name was Johnny Rosselli.
Right.
And George Herbert Walker Bush was in the same office building. It was one office there. There was a front for the CIA in that building, and they used that office. And then the spotter was a man by the name of Nestor Izquierdo, and there's a statue of him in Miami as one of the freedom fighters.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Do you want me to go over the other shooters in Dealey Plaza?
I wanted... Right before the show, you mentioned something that was new to me, because we were talking a lot about, well, basically the 40 originally were Cubans, and so, you know, it takes us down to the Caribbean, and you mentioned the killing of Bob Marley. Would you explain that a bit?
Yeah, I would like to start with John Lennon first, if that's okay.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes.
Do you know, on the evening when John Lennon came, it's important to understand what was going on at that time, because he was just about to make a major comeback after several years of taking care of his family and so on. And once again, here is a person who is standing up for peace, who is totally against this global elite's agenda, which is the name of the game for them, is death and destruction. That is the name of the game. They do not want peace. They do not want harmony. They don't want all of these things that normal people are craving for.
No.
They want the total opposite.
Right.
And so anyone that stands up and where people really listen to them, like Mahatma Gandhi, Martin Luther King, JFK, Robert Kennedy, John Lennon, Bob Marley, Lady Diana, these type of people are the one that becomes a threat to this group. And unfortunately, they have been taken out, many of them, or all of the people I mentioned. So it's a very violent group when it comes to dealing with their problems. Anyway, John Lennon was just about to make his big comeback, and they had planned for a big, big peace tour around the States and other places. And when he came this evening, he came in a limo from the recording studio together with Yoko Ono. The two left the car first. Yoko Ono started walking, and then John followed like 5-6 meters behind her. And the so-called killer was a man by the name of Mark Chapman. He was standing to the right, and John Lennon was walking in to the entrance in this Dakota building in New York, where when he was halfway in there, there were 4 or 5 shots fired. And he fell down, then started crawling into the building, and then afterwards he was taken to the hospital where he was pronounced dead and so on. But when you look at the forensic evidence, all the shots fired at Lennon came straight from the left. I mean, some of them, they were even so close together when they did the autopsy, they had problems seeing how many shots were actually fired because they were so close together, some of them. So you had Chapman standing to the right, but the shots were fired from the left. So who was standing at the left would be a good question to ask. And this evening there was a doorman by the name of Jose Perdomo, who was a nice-looking gentleman in his late 60s, so a bit bald with glasses and nice smile and so on. But when you check this guy out, he disappeared. Just after the assassination, his name was mentioned in one of the first very few broadcasts. That was when I heard it. Then it took like 6, 7, 8 years later, I think it was 7 years later, when it surfaced again. And this Jose Perdomo, for almost 10 years, he was one of the highest ranking officers in, guess what, Operation 40.
Oh,
so
my God.
So you tell me, how big are the chances? And he was also the guy who went over to Chapman and took the gun from him and said, do you know what you just did? You just shot Lennon. You just shot Lennon. And as far as I know, that was the word that triggered Mark Chapman, you know, because he was one of these MKUltra controlled patsies that they use from time to time. I don't think they ever used them for the assassination themselves because they can't be trusted as skilled killers, but they are used to take the blame for it.
Right.
And they are activated, you know, they split their personality. They put them go through awful, awful experiences, you know, where they split up the personality so that one part of the personality has absolutely no idea what the other one is doing, and they can sort of turn them on and off so they go between different parts of their personality. So one can be part of the assassination. Then when you trigger the other one, he will have absolutely no idea, no memories, no recollection, no emotions, nothing that is connected to the crime itself. And one of the typical things with these people are that they're standing like zombies after the so-called assassination. They're just stand like zombies waiting to be picked up. And same thing here with Chapman. He was just standing there waiting. They say he was even standing reading a ridiculous book, the same book as John Hinckley was standing reading after, or had they found in his room after the attack on Ronald Reagan. But it's just that they always use this, the lone crazy guy.
Right, right.
You know, the reason why they want him alone is because if there's more than one person involved, if there's two or more, then by law or by legal terms, it's a conspiracy. And if it's a conspiracy, there's always a motive behind it, you know. And then if there's a motive, there's a reason. So they try to blame it on a lone guy and that he's crazy, because if he's crazy, then he just walked off and shot the guy for no reason whatsoever. So let's just get rid of the patsy, put him in jail, bury him, case closed, goodbye, farewell, let's move on. That's the whole idea. Do not dig into it. Do not look into what was the real reason that whoever was taken out. That's the whole point.
Right, and that the way you just said that was perfect. About the lone person is crazy, two or more is a conspiracy, and a conspiracy means there's a reason. And then it's more like, well, finding out, and you may find out this and that. So you stick with the lone crazy guy.
Yeah, right. They want case closed as soon as possible, you know.
Right. Yeah.
And that's also why when they do these assassinations, they have their own investigation on standby when it comes to these bigger assassinations, so that it's people that they control themselves, that this investigation is on standby. So when the shots are fired, these people move in right away and knock out all normal, honest, decent police officer and detectives and so on. They push to the side. And then this inside investigation is put there only to put the lid on. You know, do not look into the real truth. They're just put there to point, they went that away, they went that away, they went that, and point at Patsy at all times. So, and also take care of truth seekers like myself. You know, this is why it's very, very dangerous sometimes to be too involved in the official investigation, because they deal with you in not a very nice way.
Yeah. Well, you yourself, you left Northern Europe for the
Northern
southern
Europe.
Part. Yeah.
I had two friends who got murdered, and I had a visit myself, and it's shit scary when you deal with these type of people. So I felt time for me to leave. I don't want to be part of a statistic being found in a bathtub fully dressed, having shot myself from the back with a shotgun, that type of thing.
Right, right. Yeah. No, that had to be scary. I mean, when your friends are murdered and then you have a visit and it's like, okay, I'm on my way.
It's freaking out time, I tell you. Oof.
Yeah.
Because these people, when you see them, I'm not here to point, I'm not here to say people are evil or so on, but I think I was in Iran during the Iran-Iraq war and so on, and I saw some of these people, you know, these like almost like brainwashed killers,
mm-hmm.
who have gone through a lot of horrible things, and it's like, if not, I wouldn't say evil, but there's the light is not there, you know, the light of the spirit is not there. It's just like a cold killing machine, and that is a very scary type of person to come across.
It's very, because you when we meet people just in everyday life, the spark of humanity in each of us, like, it recognizes the other.
Yeah.
You're talking about someone that, like, you can't recognize that. It's not there. Like, they're not making a connection that you are the same as they.
Yeah, exactly. Do you know, I was in Iran. Like I said, I went on a bicycle from Sweden to South Africa. I was supposed to go there. Instead, I ended up in the middle of the war in 1984 in Iran. And one of the things that really shook me, I must say, was to see a country where suddenly people had chosen sides, you know, just like in the Civil War in America, where suddenly brothers could be one brother could be one on one side, the other on the other side, and so on. And when I was there, it was the Khomeini regime, very, very powerful and cruel at that time, and then normal people. And when I saw who chose what side, you know, who was the torturer, who was the one being tortured, who was the one you know, terrorizing people, who was the one, who was the freedom fighter, and so on. Yeah, I think you're getting to a point there in the States as well where you see people choosing sides, and it's a scary experience to see what part of the personality, if you're weak or if you are power hungry or if you're open to bribes or if you're open to personal gain, even though it might be from stepping or killing or hurting other people.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scary experience to see who's who, and I think it's up to all of us to look in the mirror and see what we will do in a situation like that, if we can manage to be courageous enough to stand up for what is true and what is right.
Yes, I think that's very good advice, actually. We need to look in the mirror. We need to do that introspection, because if you're not introspective, you're going to come to a situation that you haven't thought about. You may make a move that would be detrimental, whereas if you would have thought about it, like throw these situations at yourself and think them through now. Now's the time. You're right.
And also, this only continues because we allow it.
Yes.
This is the ridiculous thing, because the global elite, they're only a few thousand, and we're like 7 billion. So it's an absolute joke that we're allowing this to happen. But it's just because people are so asleep, or have been. I mean, there's an enormous awakening going on at the moment. That's why
there is.
I think the elite are really freaking out. That's also why they're speeding everything up, and they're getting really sloppy and clumsy and, you know, low budget with all these false flag operation and so-called mass shootings that are all fake. You know, just to freak people out, to get them to give up the guns, and so on, blame it on the guns for these mass shootings so that they can move in with a more or less military overtake. So I just want to point out, I'm absolutely pro-peace, anti-violence. I'm totally against hatred and all of these things. If you study history, Fighting back violently is not the way to do it. It's not the way to do it. The way to go forward is the Martin Luther King, Mahatma Gandhi, that way, you know.
But we always have to, you know, mention when we talk about them, because they were definitely peaceful men and they didn't raise arms. However, for their movements to work, other people, their followers, did show violence from time to time.
Of course.
Yeah. You know,
it always happens.
Yeah,
I mean,
it does. It's the way. I wanted to mention that Ole's website is lightonconspiracies.com, and on there you can find out how to help the cause, because Ole is totally... He's not funded by any governments, for sure.
that is true.
You're also doing a fundraising drive. Really, you would like to get some more money. You want to do a documentary. Would you tell us a little bit about the documentary?
Now, one of the aims, since nowadays the visual media is such a good way of reaching people, because not everybody reads books, and I mean, media is so controlled at the time, but documentary is one way where you can really make a massive statement or a revelation of what has been going on. And my part, I think, has been to be able to connect the dots. I don't know how I've got into a position where I've been able to see things that not so many other people have spotted before, but I managed to connect all of these major things from the mid-50s all the way up until today, and connect them to the same group of people using the same assassins and so on. So My aim is to get a high top quality documentary made to very visibly show how this whole thing has been carried out, how we've been duped into believing something else, and how to reveal what is going on so that we can stand up, wake up, stand in truth, and take our personal power back instead of giving it up to this group they're acting totally mad at the moment. I mean, it's what is going on is total madness. And so this would be, I think, a powerful tool that could help people wake up. And my aim is to get, I would very much love to get in, to get this done together with like a documentary filmmaker like John Pilger in Australia or somebody like that on that of that caliber. Very, very brave man, very skilled, very honorable, somebody like that. But the funding is always one of the major things. And what I'm asking for is also just to fund me as a private researcher. I've been doing this for 30 years. I have a family to feed, and it's not easy when you're on your own. I have absolutely no income from this other than support, you know. So any kind of donation is greatly, greatly appreciated. Also, I've just started a monthly newsletter where I'm going to do a lot of interviews myself and get as much top quality information out there as possible. So by signing up for that would also help me. So.
And how do we sign up for that?
It's on my website, lightonconspiracies.com, and the name of the website is not, how shall I say, I put a lot of thought into the domain name because this is exactly light on conspiracies, light into darkness, how to reveal these dark areas that have been controlling us for such a long time, this hidden hand that nobody has really, everybody has felt its presence, but nobody has really been able to understand what has been going on. So this is, I'm trying to be like a torch that goes into the dark areas without judgment or violent thoughts or hatred, but just exposing it so that it will stop. It's like a cancer growth in a beautiful body, and if we don't expose it, even though it might be painful and smelly maybe, but if we don't expose it, the body will die.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what's going on. So it's we're at a crucial time, a beautiful time, I think, because this is when we're now here. This is when it's happening. So it's an amazing time to be up here. But we need to stand up and wake up. There's no time to put on and watch another football game and pick your nose and think it's I can do it tomorrow. This is not the time to be a coward. This is not a time to be a bum. It is time to stand up, help your neighbor, help your friends, help your family, raise the energy. And by the more you stay in gratitude and positive feeling, the power of love, I'm not talking new age, blah, blah, love, I'm talking the true power of love, which is the highest frequency, that will raise us above this very low frequency of fear that they're trying to push on us from all directions in life. They're really trying to push us down with fear, 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 so that they can control us. So the higher we are in energy, the more difficult it is for us to be controlled. So I would say if you cannot do anything else, then do everything you can to raise your energy. And one of the best ways to raise your energy is by helping someone else, you know. So get out of your sofa, turn off the TV, look around yourself, see that you have a beautiful family, you've got beautiful friends around you, start talking, appreciating them, and help each other, lift it, so that we can start turning this world into this beautiful place it's supposed to be, instead of this awful, dark, controlled terror state that they are trying to push on us.
Right. It's simple but not easy sometimes, because it's simple to see, and because it looks simple, people think it wouldn't work. But, you know, we can raise our own vibrations, and we can't raise anyone else's but our own. But the more of us that raise our own, the better. I wanted to ask, you're involved in yoga, aren't you?
Yeah, Raja Yoga, that's yoga for the mind.
Yeah, and because people who are or who have that kind of a background or have some Buddhist thoughts, they sound different, you know, than a lot of other people, because you do talk about the energy, and we know everything is energy. So whether it's positive or negative, that's all up to us. It's energy is there. We make of it what we will.
But you know, like, it's now science. It's I'm not a religious man. I wouldn't say that. But
spirituality are totally different.
That's I think if Jesus came back down here now, he would wear a T-shirt where it said "God save us from religion."
Exactly.
But do you know, like, if you do experiments in a laboratory, for instance, and you have a very high frequency and a very low frequency, and you let the two meet, like the very high frequency representing love and the very low frequency representing fear, which is exactly how they are if you measure them, what happens is the two frequencies, they don't start fighting and meet in the middle, but the lower frequency, when it meets the high one, it just gets annulled. It just disappears, boom, like that. It's just when you turn on the light in a dark room, there's no fight. The light doesn't fight the shadow for it to disappear. It just disappears. And it's the same here. When we raise our frequency, our vibration, and we do that most powerfully by feeling. It's the feelings that are the important one. Feel gratitude, appreciate what you got around you, feel it. The more you feel it, the more you raise yourself, and the harder it is for them to control you. I tell you, it might sound new age and blah, blah, blah. Try it. It will work. You will see that the whole world around you will slowly change, or not slowly, sometimes very quickly, when you change your frequency, when you change your way of looking, when you come from appreciation, when you come from gratitude. When you look around you and start appreciating what you got, the world around you will change, and you will become inspirational to other people, and then that will help them. So don't focus on everything you can't do.
Right.
Or,
yeah.
You know the definition of depression? The definition of depression is I, me, and mine. My problems, I have problems, mine is worse than everybody else. That is the downward spiral. So the way to get out of depression is to focus on someone else. Go out, help someone you don't know. Do beautiful things for people without them knowing that you were the one doing it. And then when you help someone else, you feel better.
Yes.
They feel better. People who observe what is going on and see what you're doing, they feel better. So it's spreading.
It's a total win-win-win then. Yeah, I'm one of those people that keeps a gratitude journal, just because.
Excellent.
You know, if I have one of those moments, I can always go to that, and it's like, my goodness, all the things I am grateful for, and I don't know any other way, because I've always loved life.
Mm.
So that doesn't mean that we don't get discouraged sometimes, but our discouragement doesn't last nearly as long as others, I've noticed. We may have one of those days or one of those hours or something, but I don't know. I can't think of my last one. So I really think that's
good advice. Can I just say, no one has said that this would be an easy trip, you know?
Exactly.
And this is also the thing. Do you know, the native Indians, they say that we, the people here, and the souls that are here at this time of this exciting time of amazing change,
yes,
We are the chosen of the chosen. We are the strongest of the strong who have chosen to come down here. We've actually been elected by our ancestors. We have been the one handpicked to come down and face these challenges. So this is not a time to wimp out and say, I don't want to be here. I don't. Be honored instead. Feel the strength and power within yourself. And then instead of focusing on everything that cannot be done and how powerful this elite is and how controlled we are, focus on the things you can do, you know, and just, like I say, if you can't do anything else, focus on raising the energy. You know, like if you go down the highway and you come to a toll booth or something like that, pay for the one car that's coming after you, someone you've never seen before. Pay for two people, you know, it's a few, maybe a dollar or something like that.
Yeah.
That thing might inspire the person who comes afterwards to do incredible things.
Right.
And it just starts spreading like that. And this is, well, this positive power is something that this elite is fearing major.
That's the thing about a smile. When you're walking down the street, like, don't frown at everyone you meet. Smile, you know, be nice to the people you meet. You may be the only person that gives them a smile today. Somebody, maybe a salesperson or something, they've had a rough day. Be the one, you know, just smile, say something nice. You don't know how that could affect them because we all make ripples. So I'd rather make the nice ripples than the undertow kind.
But I'm not talking only on a sort of like a light level, you know, just
have a nice,
I know you're not either, but like have a nice day and this type of thing.
That's so fake. I hate that.
But what I'm saying is, but what I'm saying is that this is a way to stand up against this elite.
Yes.
You know, we're not talking, this is heavy, hardcore power. Love is powerful.
It is.
You know, like Jesus was, he was not just a wimp, you know, he was a real revolutionary, very, very courageous, standing up for love and what is right, and this is what we need now. You know, all of us to stand up to this. And the thing is that, well, you know the Wizard of Oz?
Mm-hmm.
You know the story Dorothy and the other, they're going to this major castle, mansion or whatever, and there's they come in there and this powerful voice just screaming at them, you know, I'm powerful and you are weak, you know, like this, fear me, fear me, fear me. And they could very well, you know, like throw themselves to the floor and start whimpering and all this, but they don't. They dare to stand, and then when they dare to stand up, even though they're being scared, they suddenly discover this electric cord growing in behind a curtain or something like that. And they go and have a look. And behind the curtain, there's this little old guy with a microphone and a massive amplifier. That is the elite. They're a bunch of old guys with a massive war machine. But like I say, it's just a lot of noise and sound if we stand up, if we stand in our own power and dare and just say we're not going to accept this anymore. Because the mad thing is that we are controlling ourselves.
Yes, yes.
This is the sick
thing. We make it easy for them.
Without us, they can't do it.
Yeah, but we just fall into those... those patterns of thinking that we have no power.
But we have.
We do.
We do.
Thank you, my friend, so very, very much. LightOnConspiracies.com. You can find out how to make donations. You can find out about the coming documentary. And help Belay out. He is getting the truth out, trying to help us wake up. My friend, thank you so much for coming on.
The pleasure is mine, Ruthann. Anytime, I'm here. Whatever it takes, I'm here.
Okay. Good night.
Good night.